Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The big sting in New Jersey yesterday snared a dangerous arms dealer and ended his dream of selling dozens of lethal missiles to terrorists in the United States. But does that mean the airlines are safe? Tonight, On Point, the world of black market shoulder-fired missiles and assessing the threat to American passenger planes. We begin with the arrest of Hemant Lakhani, the Indian-born British arms dealer who was the target of the complicated sting operation involving Russian, British, and American law enforcement agencies. Dan Egan covers the Justice Department and terrorism for The Washington Post. I asked him whether yesterday's sting was a triumph of law enforcement or a lucky break.
Well, they're portraying it as a law enforcement triumph. And in one respect, there's an important piece of information we don't know, which makes it hard to determine how much of it was luck and how much of it was stealth.
And that is?
Well, the information was originally tipped off to the FBI by an informant. And this informant then, as the court papers that were unsealed today lay out, this informant played a crucial role in building a case against Mr. Lakhani. So the question remains how that information initially came to the FBI, and that's not completely clear at this point. But regardless, certainly they were very patient. According to the court papers, it does appear that they built a very careful case and were willing to take their time to do it right, at least as far as it appears at this point.
Dan, take us through the key steps in how this story unfolded. It began with the FBI learning that Mr. Lakhani was in the market?
Right. Essentially that he was representing himself as an arms dealer who was willing to provide either anti-aircraft missiles or anti-aircraft guns to willing buyers.
This was an Indian-born British citizen in London.
Correct. Although he was making these representations in the New Jersey area, so he obviously has some connection there.
And then the story went global. How did it unfold?
From there, he has many conversations and negotiations with the informant I previously mentioned. And as the deal unfolds, the informant represents himself, or I guess it could be herself, as a Somali who was acting on behalf of some interested buyers who were interested in waging jihad, who wanted a missile that was capable of shooting down a commercial airliner.
But in fact, this informant was working at that point for the FBI.
Correct, correct.
Meanwhile, in Russia, the Russian authorities are cooperating.
At a certain point in the deal, Lakhani allegedly goes over to Moscow to start searching for a missile, or missiles, I should say, for a supplier. And the Russian police get word of this, and they come to the Americans and say, we've got a problem here. There's somebody who's looking to buy missiles to bring to the United States. And essentially, U.S. law enforcement says, yes, actually, we know about this. Let's work together.
Now, that's interesting. The Russians were not tipped off by the FBI. They discovered Lakhani independently and came to Washington.
As far as we can tell from the court documents and from what officials have told us thus far, that does seem to be the case.
So the Russians then approached Lakhani representing themselves as black market arms sellers.
Correct.
And eventually, over all these months, they arranged to send this single dummy SA-18 shoulder-fired missile to the United States via ship. Is that right?
Correct. Broken down in parts and shipped to the United States into a port. They haven't been precise about the port, but it's clearly in the New York, New Jersey area. And all along, according to the officials in New Jersey and New York, this was being watched by both the Russian Security Service and the Americans.
Now, this was to be the first of 50 shoulder-fired missiles that Lakhani wanted to buy. How much money actually changed hands? How much was in the pipeline?
The FBI, over a couple of transactions, deposited about $85,000 into a couple of accounts for this one missile. The 50, and this was a sort of a good faith, show us what you have sort of deal. Then the plan was, yesterday was the day when they were supposed to both take delivery of that initial missile and put down a $500,000 down payment on the order of 50 missiles. The total deal for those 50 would have been $5 million.
But instead, as of today, Mr. Lakhani and two money laundering accomplices are being held without bail in American jails.
Correct.
Dan Egan, what does this whole story tell us about the international black market in arms, how active or how weak it is?
You can look at it both ways, I suppose. I mean, the FBI, Justice Department, and others in the American government would argue that this case shows that there are people more than willing to make money by dealing with terrorists. I mean, as an aside, there have been a lot of assurances that there does not seem to be a belief that Mr. Lakhani is really a terrorist himself in the true sense of the word, that he was an opportunist, that he was in it for the money. He did make some noise during some of the tape-recorded conversations praising Osama bin Laden and that sort of thing, but I'm told that, you know, the belief is that essentially he was playing to his audience.
Mm-hmm.
So the lesson is that there are many people willing to deal in the black market who don't have a lot of compunction about where these weapons might go.
This one was tracked down, was ultimately captured. So, Dan Egan, is this ultimately, should this be a comforting story for American air travelers, for air travelers anywhere in the world, or not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously, we've also have news today. The British Airways, in a very rare move, has suspended its flights to Riyadh because of intelligence indicating a threat to its airliners in that area, and that somewhat appears to be related to a series of arrests that the Saudis made of terrorist operatives who were said to be interested in attacking airplanes. So I'm not sure how comforting, at least I would take it.
And does the fact that the FBI had an informant who alerted them to this one potential arms trafficker indicate that they're super well wired now into the world of potential arms traffickers?
Well,
or
I'm sure that's what they would argue. And certainly it shows that at least in one case they were. Mm-hmm. And they've made many FBI agents and managers that I've talked to over the last 2 years have made it very plain that that is one of their primary goals, is to improve their human intelligence, essentially, to improve their contacts within these often shady communities. And I guess this is an example of at least one instance where they were successful.
But we read of maybe hundreds of U.S. Stinger missiles, maybe thousands of these Russian SA-18 shoulder-fired missiles potentially out there loose in the black market. It's easy to imagine, or maybe it's just a fantasy, but these things just raining down on the United States.
Yeah, there's a thriving black market for this stuff. And in some places, particularly Russia, there have long been concerns about a lack of controls. And maybe perhaps this can also be shown as an example of the Russians beginning to wake up as well.
Dan Egan, thanks for your time.
All right, thank you.
Dan Egan covers the Justice Department and terrorism for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. With a shoulder-fired missile, one man can take down an aircraft. No need for elaborate schemes. With a little training, it's just point and shoot. For the Mujahideen fighting the Russian occupation of Afghanistan in the 80s, the arrival of the shoulder-launched missile marked a celebrated turning point. But after that war, the genie was out of the bottle. Growing numbers of shoulder-fired missiles streamed into a global black market. The arrest of Hemant Lakhani in New Jersey yesterday shows that law enforcement is paying attention. But in an era of terrorism, black market missiles are a disconcerting and very real threat, and the source of many questions. If so many black market shoulder-fired missiles are out there, why haven't more U.S. planes gone down? If one, two, or three passenger planes were knocked out of the sky by such missiles, what would happen to air travel, to the U.S. economy? How do we mop up the loose threat or live with it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Alan Cooperman, Assistant Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. His research in the 90s told the full story of how shoulder-fired missiles poured into global black markets from Afghanistan. Good evening and welcome, Professor Cooperman.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Give us a sense, if you would, of the scale of loose shoulder-fired missiles that are out in a black market, or at least out of control of sovereign states at this point, Alan Cooperman. What are we talking about here?
Well, you can divide the problem in two. There's the U.S.-supplied missiles that are on the black market, and then there are the Russian-supplied missiles. The U.S.-supplied missiles stem from the U.S. decision in the 1980s to arm the Mujahideen rebels in Afghanistan. And the CIA ultimately provided more than 900 of these Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen, but the Mujahideen only fired around 350 of these missiles.
And the other 550, what happened?
Well, some of them may have gone under Pakistan's control, but the estimates are somewhere between 300 and 600 went to essentially a black market, meaning either that these Islamic rebels held on to them for future use, or some were sold to Iran, and others may just have gone onto the black market. The CIA tried to buy these back, but they were singularly unsuccessful, even though they bid exorbitant prices for them. Whoever had the missiles did not want to sell them back to the U.S.
So there's 300 to 600 Stinger missiles, U.S.-made, dating back to the 1980s. But what we were looking at in yesterday's Sting was Soviet-made SA-18. What do the numbers look like there?
Well, it's very hard to pin down how many are on the black market. I don't have a good estimate. I don't know that anyone has a good estimate.
I'm looking at a story from the Guardian newspaper in London that came out this morning. They quote Russian experts from November of last year saying tens of thousands of Igla and Strela missiles had leaked into circulation from poorly guarded arsenals in the 1990s. Does that sound credible to you? Tens of thousands?
It's impossible to say that it's impossible, and it's certainly possible. There are all sorts of kinds of Russian missiles. There's the old SA-7. There are thousands upon thousands in the black market. The good news is that the missile is not as good as a Stinger missile. The bad news is that pretty much any missile that's working is good enough to knock down a civilian airliner.
What do you make of the fact that in all these years of these missiles being out and about, they have not been that often used, and not that many prominent shootdowns? What is the history of the use of these shoulder-fired missiles since the war in Afghanistan ended?
Well, the estimate is that worldwide there have been somewhere between 30 and 40 civilian aircraft shot down with these surface-to-air missiles, these man-portable weapons.
Ooh, that's more than I thought. That's more than I understood.
They're not very publicized because none have occurred in the United States, mm-hmm, or Britain or one of our close allies. They've mainly taken place in war zones. So these are places that are having civil wars like Bosnia or Tajikistan, mm-hmm, something like that. And they're sometimes used against military targets, and they're sometimes used against civilian targets. But the real question is, why haven't they yet been used against a large Western airliner?
Now, we know that there was the attack on an Israeli 757 in Mombasa, Kenya, last fall. It failed, but it was a close thing. How vulnerable are civilian passenger airliners to this kind of shoulder-fired missile?
Well, that's the scary part. Essentially, civilian airliners are sitting ducks. They're extremely vulnerable. And the reason is that military aircraft have all sorts of countermeasures that they can take against surface-to-air missiles. These are either tactical or technical.
That is technical in moving, flying quickly out of the way, or technical?
No, that would be tactical. Tactical is doing all sorts of evasive maneuvers so that when you take off straight up almost, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And therefore you get out of range very quickly. Or you spiral up or down when you're approaching so that you're never very far from the airfield.
This would not be popular on a commercial passenger airliner, spiral.
It would not be possible, for example, to go up very quickly in a commercial airliner. So that technical countermeasure is not possible. The technical countermeasures involve things like flares, so that since these are infrared-seeking missiles, what you do is you light flares, and those go off from the airplane, and the missile chases the flare instead of chasing the airplane.
But we read that a number of these missiles now are not fooled by flares. They chase the plane anyway.
That's correct. So the military has developed two different kinds of advanced countermeasures, technical countermeasures. One is a passive infrared, which is sort of an old technology, and now they have a directed infrared, which uses lasers to fool the incoming missile. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good, and it's good enough that the military has ordered them for some of its transport planes.
But the cost of putting those on all 6,000 or 7,000 American passenger liners, or 12,000 passenger liners worldwide, many billions. We'll come back and talk about whether that or not that might be feasible and what the real threat is. We're looking tonight with Alan Cooperman at the big Sting and a world awash in shoulder-fired missiles. Does the Sting in New Jersey yesterday calm your fear of Stingers, of shoulder-fired missiles, or does it stoke it up
And if so many black market missiles are out there, why haven't more U.S. planes come down? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about black market missiles and the threat to American passenger airliners. You can join the conversation. If one, two, three passenger liners were dropped, knocked out of the sky by terrorist missiles, what would happen to air travel, to the U.S. economy? And is this just one more dark thought to carry on to your next flight? Does it change your behavior? Would it if a plane came down? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been talking tonight with Alan Cooperman of Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. We're joined now from Washington by David McIntyre. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel, former dean of the National War College, and deputy director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security. Good evening and welcome, David McIntyre.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. David McIntyre, what's your assessment of the sting we saw yesterday in New Jersey? What does it say about the effectiveness of law enforcement when it comes to this universe of out-of-pocket, shoulder-fired missiles? How serious a threat do you see in these missiles?
A serious threat if you have a skilled individual with a working missile and the opportunity. But you have a lot of moving parts that sort of have to get to the same place at the same time. We've talked about a lot of missiles being loose in the world, and there certainly are, and not just U.S. and Russian. These things have been made in lots of different countries around the world, and I have no question that there are some available through organized crime and other means. But it's not like just pulling a flashlight off the shelf and pointing it. I've worked with them. I've exercised with them. I've practiced with them. And it does take a bit of skill to track. You do have problems of batteries that have shelf lives. You do have problems of rocket motors that have shelf lives. The individuals have to practice with this. I can tell you our people who use the Stingers for a living practice with them very, very frequently. Otherwise, their skills degrade. And so it's not simple to do. It is possible, and so that does make it a concern.
What do we know about who has surface shoulder-fired missiles? I've seen conflicting reports. Today, U.S. officials telling Reuters off the record that they don't think al-Qaeda has them. Other reports in the press this week saying al-Qaeda does have shoulder-fired missiles. What do we know?
I don't think there's any way for us to know. I think the intelligence agencies are receiving conflicting information, and I think that you'd find that if you picked two analysts, they would regard the information with slightly different answers, and so you and I are just not going to have an answer to that. We're just kind of live with the fact that we are in a new technological era, and things that were available only to major powers 15 years ago are now readily available to people around the world. But now it's not only missiles. Let me tell you that as an air traveler, and I travel a lot, I'm much more concerned about the last 30 minutes on the ground than I am taking off or when I'm airborne.
You mean some kind of ground attack?
Right. If you really want to think about it, what is the moment at which an aircraft and its passengers and crew are most vulnerable? It's when they have the largest amount of fuel in their stationary at an airport. So yeah, my point is that, yes, the story about the use of shoulder-fired missiles is possible, and it is an issue we're going to have to think about in this modern age when lots of weapons and technology is available. But it isn't something that ought to paralyze us, even if an aircraft were brought down.
Well, there are so many holes we could step in these days. We try to look at them one by one to assess them. Alan Cooperman, we read that just in the last couple of months, the Bush administration has been warning of a high and rising risk of attack by these kinds of missiles. They've sent teams out around the world to look at airports to assess their vulnerability. Can civilian airports be made invulnerable to the threat of shoulder-fired missiles?
Well, that's an easy question. The answer is no. The reason is that most of these missiles have a range of somewhere between 10 and 15,000 feet. And if aircraft, commercial aircraft, go at their usual rate of ascent, they are at that height for anywhere from 10 to 20 miles away from the airport. So you imagine an airport in anything like an urban environment and draw a circle around that of 20 miles and then say, okay, I'm going to prevent any one guy on a rooftop with a missile from taking a shot. And you realize, no, it's not really feasible. What you can, I mean, you could alter flight paths so that they went over less populated areas. You could try to get the planes to take spiral takeoff routes so that they would, you know, this diameter that you draw around an airport would be smaller. But really, it is not going to ever be feasible to secure a large enough perimeter around a commercial airfield. So that's not the way to solve this problem.
It's just not. So, and what do you make, Alan Cooperman, of the fact that these missiles have been out there for years now, but there have not been in the United States attacks on U.S. planes? David McIntyre points to a couple of potential reasons that they're not that technically dead simple to use. You've got to have training. They've got to be fresh enough on the battery front to work. But do you chalk it up to that, or is something else going on here?
Well, first of all, the colonel is right that you do need to be trained on these things, but I wouldn't exaggerate how much training you need. The Mujahideen, when they were trained in Pakistan prior to the use of these things in 1986 for the first time, when they took their first shots, they hit 3 out of their 4 first shots. They brought down aircraft. So those were folks who had training, but they never actually had used it in combat before. But as for why they haven't been used against American aircraft, it's speculation, but I would say there's two reasons. Number one is mostly these things have been used in civil wars. So in other words, whoever has them has a higher priority at this point or in the past.
Because their side is fighting for its life, and so they go out and buy them.
That's right. And they use them against military targets in a civil war, and they don't want to waste them on civilian aircraft. Mm-hmm. And then the second reason, I think, is just that if you're going to try and use it in the United States, you do have to get this weapon into the United States. And presumably we're looking for these kinds of things. We have human intelligence around the world. It's maybe not perfect, but either it has prevented or it has deterred folks from getting these weapons into the United States so far. At least we hope so.
But David McIntyre, it just doesn't sound like it would be that difficult. We are told these would fit in a golf bag. We see the mountains of containers coming into ports day after day in the United States. It doesn't seem to be that tough to get one into the country.
Well, there's a famous dark joke in the Homeland Security community. How would you smuggle a nuclear weapon into the United States? You'd hide it in a bale of marijuana. Those seem to get through all right.
Yes,
you are exactly right that a relatively small piece of equipment is going to be relatively easy to bring in if you have no warning. Imagine a 40-story building on its side. That's about what a ship is like. Now imagine that you've got to search several hundred of those a day with crews who may or may not speak English, and you're looking for something that's 4 feet long and 6 inches around. A very daunting task, and that's why all of the people that we have who specialize in this business have said from the beginning, we just can't answer this problem at the ports. We've got to begin with overseas. You begin with intelligence and the murky world where intelligence and law enforcement cross. You move on to look at what who ships and how can we identify some of those people and get them to work with us to make the shipping safer. Then out of what ports and how can we secure some of those ports and even put our customs people on the ground. And then what to actually ships and crews carry them over. So the idea is you begin not by saying, can I find the needle in the haystack at the port? You begin by clearing away the straw before you ever leave the other country so that there are relatively few ships and targets you have to take a look at as it comes into the United States.
And what about the Russian front in this whole effort? The Russian authorities were very cooperative in this particular sting this week, but we read that just a couple of months ago, the Russian defense minister, Sergei Ivanov, held an emergency summit in Kazakhstan with all the Confederation of Independent States exactly because of this problem. This report of perhaps thousands of shoulder-fired Russian missiles out there. The Soviets have had their own problems in Chechnya, big choppers shot down by these weapons. And the Russians calling for an international watchdog group to be set up to monitor this black market trade. Is it possible, we're looking at these reports, thousands of these missiles having come into black market circulation from Russia or in Russia in the 1990s, David McIntyre?
Well, we don't know the exact numbers, but we do know that not just in Russia, but all through the former Soviet Union, there were weapons depots that were left unguarded or left poorly guarded, or who had very low paid guards who were willing to look the other way. So it isn't just these missiles that we need to be worried about. I suspect that organized crime, the great fear in the counterterrorism community, I think, for some time has been that organized crime and the terrorist would get together, because if they ever do, then you have a very powerful force with a variety of different skills. Now, on the good side, we've had more than 60 nations that have worked together in this counterterrorism intelligence organization. And we are also seeing some progress. I don't mean to put a happy face on it or not. I think the analysis that says this is dangerous business is exactly right. But 2 years ago, we had such infighting between intelligence and law enforcement. And what you're seeing now is international cooperation in both of those fields, and also the involvement of the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which didn't exist 8 months ago. You know, 8 months ago, when U.S. people went out to look at a ship, you had one organization that looked at the crew and the people, and an entirely different organization, chain of command, that looked at what was on board the ship.
So the Office of Homeland Security and Reorganization has brought some of these functions together, coordinated them more successfully.
That is correct. And those people today are working with the FBI, and I suspect with a variety of other agencies. The State Department keeps careful track of who is shipping weapons and who has authority to ship and so forth. So it is good news that you have a huge number of organizations that do appear to be beginning to work together and pass this information together.
Well, there's some comfort in that, but this growing understanding of the threats that we live with is a little much to take on sometimes. I want to turn to our callers. Jay is calling from Litchfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, I just have a quick question. What is the shelf life of these Stinger missiles? I mean, we're talking back to Afghanistan.
It's a long time ago now.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's put it to our guest, Alan Cooperman. How long? We heard about battery life. Is that the key factor? Rocket engine life? How long are they effective?
Well, there's no one answer, but there has been a lot of misinformation communicated. A lot of people are saying, oh, the batteries have run out. They run out after a year or two or something like that. I when I was going through archives, when I was doing my research in the 90s, I found a document from the U.S. Central Command, which stated, and I'll quote, the power source required to activate the Stinger has a shelf life of at least 10 years with a reliability rate of 98% to 99%. That's the U.S. Army.
But we're into the 20th year since some of these Afghan battles, aren't we?
Almost. They started being delivered in 86, and so now we're 17 years out. It's possible some of them are having reliability problem. And, for example, there was one of these missiles fired from an Iranian boat at a U.S. aircraft when we were escorting ships in the Persian Gulf in the 80s. And that thing hit the helicopter but didn't explode. So not all of these work perfectly. But I wouldn't assume that they've all conked out.
It's no longer just the Afghan-era Stingers that, as you both told us this evening, are on the market. I want to welcome into our conversation Josh Marks, joining us from Washington, D.C. He's Associate Director of the Aviation Institute at George Washington University. Good evening and welcome, Josh Marks.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Josh, a lot of tremor passing through the airline industry with the new attention on surface or shoulder-fired missiles. We're reading today Andrew Brooks at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London saying this thing is one of the great kept secrets that people don't want to talk about, especially with airlines having the financial problems they have. The notion is out there in the U.S. Congress of a $10 billion plus program to fit all 6,000 or 7,000 U.S. commercial passenger airliners with defensive technology. How real is that idea? Is there any way that U.S. passenger planes could be equipped with technology to make them invulnerable or safer from shoulder-fired missiles?
Well, that's really the big question these days. I think if you approach the problem from a technological perspective, you see that spending $10 to $12 billion to retrofit 4,000 or 5,000 domestic airliners with defense systems against these missiles is not going to result in a tremendous degree of additional safety for passengers on board.
Why not?
Well, if you're trying to defend against the old SA-7 Grails, the 1980s model,
the old Russian missiles.
Then putting on board jamming systems, IR jamming systems, can give you some additional margin of safety. But these missiles were really only effective when fired from the rear at the engines of an aircraft. Now, of course, civilian airliners, as they take off from airports, have an enormous heat signature. It's not difficult to hit one of these airplanes. And even an SA-7, when fired properly, assuming it works, can inflict fatal damage to an aircraft.
And you're talking about the older generation missiles. What about the newer ones?
The newer ones are downright scary. An SA-18, the Ilha, which was intercepted yesterday, can be fired head-on at an aircraft. And for an aircraft the size of a 747 or Boeing 777, a jumbo jet, there's really not much that can be done.
Does that mean it's not following the heat signature, but rather the target itself, or how's it working?
It's following the target itself. Now, I'm not a technology expert at these jamming systems, but I do know that defending against the SA-18 and some of these newer missiles, you're really not going to get a tremendous degree of additional defense by fitting in the systems that we're talking about today. So it brings up the question, what are we getting for retrofitting these aircraft for these defense systems? Are we getting an additional $10 billion worth of safety? Are we guaranteeing that an aircraft that's fired on is not going to be hit? In the end, I think that we get back to the core argument which Alan and David have discussed, which is this is really about people and opportunities. And it's very, very difficult to protect a commercial airliner when it's taking off or landing at an airport, especially if it's taking off with a full load of fuel.
So it's difficult, and it would cost an awful lot of money for a marginal gain in security. But on the other hand, Josh Marks, if one or two or three American passenger liners went down, what would the impact of that be on the industry, on air travel, on the U.S. economy?
That is a difficult question as well. I think that the impact would probably be less severe than the decline in travel that we saw after September 11th. Terrorism is unfortunately more of a part of our lives and a perceived threat that we all deal with now than it was two or three years ago. At the same time, especially if you saw this kind of a terrorist strike on a wide-body aircraft, I think you would see a trend in bookings away from transatlantic flights or wide-body aircraft that were perceived as dangerous and towards smaller aircraft. And that would have an impact on the airlines. I mean,
you're saying that the wide body, the big airliners, the DC-10s, the 747s, and larger, are just simply be more attractive targets for terrorists because they have more passengers on board. Is that your point?
That's my point.
And so the move to smaller planes, private planes, but that doesn't work for most people. People have to travel on big transport most of the time.
That's right, and that's why I'm saying that the probable damage if this kind of strike were to occur would be concentrated on the high margin transatlantic, transcontinental routes. But again, I mean, this brings up another issue related to refitting these aircraft with defense systems, which is which aircraft do you retrofit? Do you retrofit them all? There are hundreds, if not thousands, of airplanes out there with a market value today of less than $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
Are we really going to put a $2 million system on an aircraft that's got 5 to 10 more years of life in the airline industry? If we only retrofit new aircraft, we're leaving a significant portion of our existing fleet uncovered.
So this sounds as though what you're conveying is that the airline industry maybe thinking the best or only thing they can do is sort of nothing.
Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of options for the airline industry itself. If the government is willing to pick up the entire tab for this, the airline industry will listen, although there are significant costs to the airlines in simply taking these aircraft out of service to have them retrofitted in the first place.
And the proposal is maybe $10 billion from the government to give them the equipment the airlines would pay to have it put on. We're talking a lot of money. Josh Marks, David McIntyre, Alan Cooperman, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the big sting in New Jersey yesterday and a world awash in shoulder-fired missiles. Does the sting give you fresh confidence in U.S. law enforcement, or does it just look lucky? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support. I'm Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about black market missiles and the threat to American passenger airliners. A sting in New Jersey yesterday led to the arrest of three, including an international arms dealer who had hoped to bring 50 shoulder-fired missiles into the United States from Russian sources, each one of which would have had the capacity, if he had succeeded, to bring down a fully loaded passenger airliner. It's not a pretty thought, and there are many of these missiles out and about in the world. My guests tonight are Josh Marks, Associate Director of the Aviation Institute at George Washington University, David McIntyre, Deputy Director of the Answer Institute for Homeland Security, and Alan Cooperman, Assistant Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. David McIntyre, I wanted to ask you about Josh Marks' comments just before the break on what the airline industry might, could, should, won't do. Are there steps that they can take, or is this just, as you've said, one of those issues that has to be dealt with by police work on the ground, not technology or tactics in the air?
It's going to be very difficult in the short term for us to make a decision. Now, it sounds like a cold, hard trade-off. I don't want to suggest that this is only a question of cash, but in all respects, not just these missiles, but in the application of technology against biological terrorism and the application of technology against proofing our buildings against chemical attack, we're going to have to make some risk analysis. Suppose that I said to you that I know a date certain when 400 Americans are going to die. Wouldn't we move heaven and earth and spend any amount of money to prevent that? Well, no, we won't, because it's 3 weeks from now on Labor Day weekend, and we accept that it's part of our lives. Now, I don't mean just...
You mean car accidents on Labor Day weekend, and we learn to absorb that psychically and materially.
That's exactly right. Now, the first time that something like this happens, it's going to be a tremendous shock to us, and so I certainly hope we can use all of these other approaches, intelligence and law enforcement, in order to prevent that from happening, because I am concerned that we would hang ourselves up on this enormous expenditure. But at this point, I'm not convinced that this big expenditure on current technology would solve the problem. Technology is progressing, and we may find that in 3 or 4 years, there are new solutions that we don't anticipate today. No, this is just the argument between sword and shield. This is just the battle between offense and defense, between cannon and castle wall that's been going on for millennia.
And different choices are made. Reuters reports today that Israeli airliners are believed to carry anti-missile systems. But I wanted to ask you, David McIntyre, why do you think, over all these years, where there have been terrorists out there who wanted to hit the United States, why have American airliners not been hit? What do you really think is going on?
That is the $64,000 question that everyone is debating, not just about these missiles, but in so many other ways. Now that we look at ourselves and we see how vulnerable we are inside to attack, the question is, why hasn't it happened yet? And the only solution I can offer is that from their perspective, targeting is a much more iffy business than we give it credit to. We sort of assume perfect knowledge on their part. We assume perfect training on their part, the availability of people to do this, and equipment and money. And putting all those pieces together with the willingness of a person to not only give their lives, but perhaps spend their life in prison in a failed attempt, this may be a little tougher than we anticipate when we look at it only as on the receiving end.
Well, that would be some slim comfort, but as history shows us, not much. Willie's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Willie. You're on the air.
Hi. I guess I want to ask about a couple of situations I read about in some newspapers briefly some years ago. A couple of airliners shot down in former Soviet republics in Central Asia. And strangely enough, these appeared in newspapers, and newspapers are quite renowned. One day, and then it was like basically gone. Nobody ever talked about it. But these were shoot downs of airliners. I assumed that these were missiles from the Mujahideen. And have there been any use that anything of the ones that were? We gave quite a few of them to the Contra terrorists in Nicaragua too.
Let me ask. Your line's a little bit rough, but thanks for calling, Willie. Alan Cooperman, how about it? We know that there are a lot of these missiles were produced in the Soviet Union, in Russia. We read that they're available on the black market there for as little as $500, not the 80-some thousand that Hemant Lakhani was prepared to pay. And we have this report of the Russian defense minister calling together all of his folks there for an emergency meeting. There have been Russian military aircraft that have gone down in Chechnya. Have there been civilian airliners that are confirmed downings by shoulder-fired missiles there?
There are two publicized studies. One is the FBI's own estimates, which are there have been 29 cases in which civilian planes have been hit by shoulder-fired SAMs, causing up to 550 deaths. And then the RAND Corporation did a study almost a decade ago that said by 1992, their estimate was that there had been 40 hits on civilian airliners.
This is globally.
These things do happen. And so it shows that it can happen, that the folks can get both the missiles and the training, right, as we talked about earlier, sufficient to knock down these aircraft. So it can be done. And as for why it hasn't been done in the U.S., I mean, we've speculated a lot on this program already. But, you know, there's also the fact that the big groups may be thinking, let's go for the big hit. Does anyone think that the September 11th folks could not have brought down a plane with a SAM? No, sure they could have, but they decided to store up, keep their powder dry, and then go for the big hit, which is what they accomplished.
So that would be too small. Yet on the Russian front, again from the Russian defense minister, recently reportedly saying that 50 of these missiles were stolen just this month or last month from an arsenal near St. Petersburg, later found abandoned in a rubbish dump. I mean, you get the feeling that they're just rolling all over the place. Sharon's calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Sharon. You're on the air.
Thank you. Great conversation. I came in kind of with thoughts about Afghanistan in this way. When 9/11 first happened, I think we wanted to get in there to get a handle on this terrorist group there. And there was also discussion, though, of putting more resources into kind of international cooperation, you know, so using our resources that way and to kind of clear out things in Afghanistan. Instead, we pretty much let go of Afghanistan, from what I'm reading, that is a real sloppy mess right now, that we really didn't follow through. And so, you know, the fact that there might be all kinds of weapons there is kind of getting away from us. And instead of cooperating with the rest of the world, putting our resources into, like you said, people on the ground and our different services that can investigate and be in contact, then we next went into Iraq. So my question of the gentleman there is, mm-hmm. you know, the way we use our resources, what is more realistic now? One of my thoughts, too, is if we could just get the United Nations, at least at this late point, involved in Iraq, we need to use our resources, I think, in a way that's a people intelligence type of thing. And I really appreciated the comments about, you know, how much can you do with technology at this point?
Well let's ask. And thanks for your call, Sharon. David McIntyre, how about it? You mentioned some reorganization in U.S. Law enforcement agencies that you see as having worked well in this instance. And we saw cooperation between British and Russian and U.S. law enforcement agencies in yesterday's sting. But on a larger scale, our caller's asking, might resources be better applied differently to address this and other terrorist threats?
I'm not sure. I don't know an area that I could point to. My problem in trying to answer that is I don't know an area that I would point to where I would say a different set of resources at this point would make a huge amount of difference. Now, the issue of working with Afghanistan and Iraq were to try to address short-term immediate problems. And there has been some progress in that area. For example, we do know that there were places on the ground where there were mock-ups of airfields, mock-ups of aircraft, where people practiced taking over aircraft, and they no longer have access to those resources because we have taken them out.
In Afghanistan.
But that is a short-term, immediate issue. The real problem, the long-term problem, is this business of establishing the intelligence connections, establishing trust, working sometimes with very unsavory people, establishing trust between nations. And it does, everyone that I talk to suggests to me that there has been a great deal of progress made there, but it's very slow. It happens over a long period of time, and I just don't think we're going to, in the last 2 years, we can just turn on a dime and suddenly say, you know, Interpol, we haven't really put a lot of priority on it. We'll just put some money there. It's going to take a longer investment and some patience, unfortunately. This is a great step forward. I'm really glad to see this. I wish we could see public evidence of other things, places that were working well together. It's just a very long, slow process.
And a last word, Alan Cooperman, my sense from what everyone's saying tonight is that there is not a way to somehow mop up these missiles. They're going to be out there and be out there for some time.
Well, that's true. And the one area I think I would disagree with the other two folks on the program is this question of retrofitting aircraft. It's true it's not perfect. It's true that if you put directed infrared countermeasures on commercial aircraft, they still might be brought down. But the chances of them being brought down would be much smaller.
And, so you say bring on the flares, bring on the technology. With that, I'm afraid...
Not the flares.
Okay.
But, Okay, but it's just a few billion dollars.
Just a few billion dollars for defensive systems. Watch Congress. It's going to be a live issue there. Alan Cooperman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Alan Cooperman is at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. David McIntyre and Josh Marks, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
David McIntyre is at Answer Institute for Homeland Security. Josh Marks at George Washington University. In a moment, a group of military families launch an effort to bring American soldiers home from Iraq. A coalition of military veterans and parents with children stationed in Iraq is launching a new campaign today to end the Iraqi occupation. The project is called Bring Them Home Now, a twist on President Bush's infamous challenge to Iraqi resistors, Bring Them On. Organized as a resource for military families and a political sounding board, the group unites anti-war activists with those already disenchanted with the U.S. occupation. Susan Schumann's son, Justin, is a National Guard sergeant stationed in Samarra, north of Baghdad. She shared her son's current circumstances at today's press conference launching Bring Them Home Now.
My son, Justin, has been stationed in northern Iraq since late March. He often works 20 hours a day. He lives in a 12 by 14 foot room with five other guys and an abandoned Iraqi police barracks where the temperature often reaches 120 degrees. Water is rationed to 2 liters a day. He has eaten only MREs for the last 130 days. Living conditions are tough. But more importantly, he and his colleagues are in constant danger. He said to me, the U.S. just doesn't understand. There are 30 to 40 major incidents here a day, and the U.S. news does not report that. The news only shows one or two incidents, only talks about one or two deaths or one or two illnesses. The ground truth, as our troops from who are in Iraq say, is chaos, lack of planning, lack of basic supplies and equipment, lack of personnel. Our troops are stuck in a quagmire of urban desert guerrilla warfare for which they are not prepared or equipped. 60 to 70% of the infantry troops in Iraq are reserves or National Guardsmen, often lured into the reserves through the promise of education and opportunity and for financial reasons. They're dedicated and proud and joined to serve their country, but they're not prepared for the kind of constant combat guerrilla situation that they're encountering. They're not trained for that. They're not special forces. They're scared, and they don't have enough support. My son says we have no vehicles, we have no radios, we have no nada. How are we supposed to do our job here? As my son says, we're out here flapping. My son joined the National Guard to serve his country. Massachusetts National Guard has a long and proud tradition dating back from the Minutemen. What service does he do to his country now? Is this country any safer? Is Justin any safer? Are the troops in Iraq any safer? Are the Iraqis any safer? No, 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 and no. Our sons and daughters have been betrayed by the Bush administration. Bring Justin home now and bring our troops home now.
Susan Schumann is the mother of National Guard Sergeant Justin Schumann, who is stationed in Samarra, Iraq. She spoke earlier today in Washington, D.C. at a press conference launching a new campaign called Bring Them Home Now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this program comes from Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate IT networks.